continuing our discussion about race and policing in America, the events of the last week, and how our community here in the Commonwealth is responding, we've heard this hour from people who attended protests last night and from Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins just now on how he's thinking about issues of race and policing today. We want to now bring in some historical perspective. Joining us to do that is Khalil Gibran Muhammad. He's a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Khalil.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let me just begin by asking you your reaction to how the nation is responding to what happened to George Floyd, especially in a larger context, and how are you responding personally?
Well, I think that generally speaking, we are seeing the largest demonstrations in a half a century with respect to systemic racism. It's not an accident that we'd have to go back to the late 1960s, which produced years and years worth of civil unrest and uprisings, eventually leading to the Kerner Commission report that documented in city after city systemic racism, institutional discrimination, and a whole lot of police violence. The irony, of course, is that the Kerner Commission report was more or less shelved by Johnson. He did not run for re-election in 68. Nixon won, and so began four decades of the war on crime and the war on drugs and mass incarceration. So here we are.
You know, one of the things that struck me in reading an op-ed that you put together last July, so almost a year ago, was the litany of reports over really the last 20 years, so quite recently, of unconstitutional policing behavior after investigations were done in cities across the country. It was a huge number of reports that found unconstitutional policing.
Yeah, so, you know, Americans have short memories and small appetites for these kinds of very candid displays of what racism looks like, in part because most Americans, particularly white Americans, have not had to wrestle with these issues in their daily lives, and we do a poor job in our K-12 school systems. But, you know, we've been having blue ribbon commissions of one kind or another, or DOJ consent decrees and pattern and practice investigations for a century. And, you know, we're talking about Detroit, New Orleans, Seattle, Cleveland, East Haven, New York, Albuquerque, Portland, Oregon, Baltimore, Los Angeles. I mean, I'm just naming city after city going back to the 1990s when the DOJ started to do such things, saying essentially the same thing, that we have a systemic problem of police bias on one end and outright constitutional violations of civil liberties on another.
Khalil, I know that we have listeners that have been hearing our coverage over the last week and feeling very frustrated that this sustained conversation about police brutality, about the way police in America treat Black Americans, is disrespectful, that it doesn't recognize the life and limb that police officers risk in doing their jobs, that it doesn't recognize that when somebody throws things at you, frozen water bottles, rocks, you're at risk and need to react. How do we put that piece of the concern in this larger context of the history of oppressive and unconstitutional behavior that we also know has played out, as you just said, in police departments around the country?
Well, first of all, I'd say that every citizen has the constitutional right to say what they think about the police in the presence of the police. They have a right to object to a police action. They don't have a right to resist arrest when the lawful arrest is being made, but they most certainly can question officers. What we're seeing on the streets in terms of the protests, the water bottles, that's not the context in which the problem of policing is playing out. That's just a reaction to the protest itself. So I would say that the vast majority of African Americans are experiencing and have been experiencing for 100 years a kind of everyday form of subtle aggression and physical abuse when it escalates to that point. I mean, the evidence on stop and frisk is just unimpeachable when it comes to 4.4 million people having been stopped just in one city alone, 90% of them Black or brown, less than 10% of them being issued even so much as the summons. And each one of those forms of contact could lead to the kind of sense that you don't belong in this society, that you don't have the right to come and go as you please. So the record is very clear that the kind of policing that police officers have been empowered to do, that has been lawful, that has been sanctioned by elected officials and other authorities, has been profoundly hurtful and discriminatory to the African-American community. And that some people will say that's anti-police is so fundamentally part of the problem. The privilege of expecting that other people will be subjected to the kinds of conditions that make you think that you don't belong is what systemic racism in America is all about. So I don't have a lot of patience for that kind of response. Also, policing is not a form of conscription. You're not drafted into policing. So if people think that they get to demand respect from a citizen, which is not what is required in policing, police officers do not have to be respected by the citizens of this country in order for them to do their jobs. It would be nice, and we spend a lot of time talking about trust and legitimacy, which I think are good things, but the notion that you actually can be lawfully beat down or embarrassed or have a dog put on you like was happening in Ferguson systematically because you have an attitude with the police is exactly the wrong problem to focus on.
So let's talk about reform for a minute, Khalil. You've talked on you've written in numerous instances about complaints, investigations into questionable practices in police departments that have gone unattended. More of the same has followed. We've seen something similar play out with the Minneapolis Police Department, where we know, for example, Officer Derek Chauvin had nearly 20 complaints against him. We've heard, I think you've been listening all hour, I think you heard Shigan Itawu at the beginning of the hour express frustration over protests over and over again and the systemic change not happening. What has to happen for police forces, systems of police, I'm not finding the right word that I want, but for individual police departments to begin to take on and enact those reforms? How do we get there?
Well, I'm sorry to say that all that history and all those reports and all the evidence suggest that you can't get there by asking police to do something that they're not capable of doing. Not going to happen. And, I mean, it's like suggesting that climate change is going to happen if we just figure out how to make cleaner coal. Not going to happen. You don't get there. So how do you get there? We have to decide that we want police officers to do less of what they do, to do less mental health care, to do less nuisance calls, to do less crime prevention where simply living in a high crime area makes you a suspect because the people who live around you in high crime areas, less high crime areas will feel safer. So that includes defunding the police. It includes positioning public resources in public budgets for community health initiatives, public health initiatives, community workers who already have proven track records like Cure Violence Global, for example, which I admittedly I'm on the board of, but have proven track records of violence interruption and other forms of non-police community interventions.
We spoke with Michael Bradley earlier today, Upton, Massachusetts police chief, about whether there are specific concrete reforms he'd support to hold back actors accountable. I want to play a little bit of what he had to say for you.
We're always looking to hold our people accountable, to discipline officers when it's appropriate. You know, I'm sure there is work that can be done through the unions, through arbitration. There may be some steps that can be taken there to improve the ability to remove police officers that are unfit to do the job.
In our last minute or so, if there are police departments and police officials like that ready to and willing to take the steps, what are the policy moves that need to be made at local and regional levels in order to create those conditions?
Well, he's absolutely right. The unions are a huge impediment to system change, agency change, department by department. Bad apples, when they are very clearly rotten, are reimposed or reinstituted on departments because of union or collective bargaining agreements. And if they do manage to get fired from one department, they move on to another because of protections of privacy between one department and agency and another, or certainly protections with the public. So we need much stronger collective bargaining agreements that shift a lot of power away from unions to protect officers regardless of their behavior and how their values may not align with the organization. It's also true that we need far more independent scrutiny. The call for civilian review boards has been going back to the 1920s. It hasn't happened, and the reason it hasn't happened because it is a strong mechanism for holding police officers accountable to public standards. So it's not, it's, again, if we're going to expect them to change themselves, then we, the public, and the elected officials who represent us are going to have to do the hard work of making those changes.
And that is Khalil Gibran Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.